Luther in this sermon is commenting on a passage in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 16, that talks about God's anger. It was a word that he liked to comment on, the orge in Greek, the wrath of God, that you could almost hear him rolling the R if you were saying it in English, wrath of God. Maybe you've heard sermons about the wrath of God in your life. So that's the text that he's commenting on. It's in the year 1542. There is no greater wrath of God than his silence, such as that with which the Jews are now being treated. Against them, the wrath of our Lord God is so severely inflamed that not one little word or one sign has come from him in 1500 years. They cry vehemently and pray very ardently, as the books which contain their prayers show. And we'll be studying some of those books this afternoon. If I could pray as they pray, I would give a cup worth 200 florins for such zeal. I wonder why God does not hear them. It is God's wrath, God's unspeakable wrath. He talks about the prophet Isaiah. He says, listen to the prophet Isaiah. Indeed, the Jews wanted to club him to death. And here you have God's own son. Indeed, they wanted to club him to death. So we hear again this theme of deicide, accusing the Jews of being the God killers. And so our Lord God is now repaying the Jews in kind, as we see all about us. This is what happens to lost children who do not want to listen to their parents and thereafter are spurned by their parents. No one has ever adequately described this wrath, nor can anyone write about it adequately. No eloquence is able to explain it. Yesterday we saw that, Monday, we saw the last time we were together, that the binding of Isaac is a very complicated and mysterious passage. We had two people in the group read it, a male voice and a female voice, suggesting that the text as we have it in the Bible now is itself a stitched together version of at least two strands or two versions of the reality. And only towards the end did I disclose that in Jewish interpretation of the story, did the fact that Isaac sets off with his father on this strange journey to Mount Moriah and doesn't come back with him in verse 19 to the two servants who are left there waiting, is accounted for in some later Jewish traditions during the Christian centuries, roughly in the 11th century and then later in times of persecution of the Jews by Christians, as divine warrant for killing their own children rather than to let them blaspheme the holy name of God by becoming Christians. So that the attitude of hostility of Christians towards Jews has led to the strange result at the very heart of the passage in Genesis, which is to condemn child sacrifice, to condemn human sacrifice, and to speak of temple worship and the place of animals and little lambs as a sweet odor of sacrifice to God, gets lost sight of in the face of this overarching duty of the first commandment that the Jews profess fidelity to, not to have the name of some strange god before them. They, of course, cannot be expected in the situation of forced conversions to accept the Trinitarian faith as anything other than a violation of the first commandment. And it's something that we need to know and respect Jews for, rather than to force them to this awful distortion of their own tradition. There's lots more to be said about the binding of Isaac story. It's one of the most poignant, moving stories of the entire Hebrew Bible. And we'll see that it recurs in the Passover narrative that we explore today. But because I want to make this something that really relates to the life of the Christian community at prayer, I've carefully selected passages that in fact recur in our prayer life as Christians. And so I put the first question, does anybody know when the story of the binding of Isaac occurs in the liturgical life of the church? When is it read out in church publicly for our edification, for our own upbuilding and nurturing as a faith? Anybody happen to know?
Is that the that during Lent?
It is during Lent, and even more particularly in Lent. Can anybody sort of focus it? I don't want to be picky about the point. It's the last possible moment of Lent, or you could say it in a different way. It's the the last possible moment of Passion Week. It's you're all very, very close now. Just follow the clues. It's Easter Vigil, the Paschal Vigil. And then I'd put the question, is there anybody that would happen to know this, and this would be beyond our normal experience, but where do you think the church got that habit, that custom of reading the story of the Binding of Isaac on the night in which Christians were admitted to the new community in the baptismal service of the Passover? Any clues, any ideas? Well, let me give you a clue back. The church's liturgy is pretty much built on the synagogue liturgy. It follows the structure and form of what, the earliest Christians, as we pointed out last time, the big obvious ones, Jesus, Peter, Paul, and Mary, they were all Jews. And so the customary way of their nurturing their spirituality was to listen to the Hebrew Bible and to sort out the way in which it related to their life. And so it was from the synagogue service that they took this idea of where to situate the text of the Binding of Isaac in a public proclamation. Now that's the clue. When do you think Jews read it in the synagogue service? Passover time, that's right. Jews obviously celebrate Passover en famille, as you say in French, or in at home, in the family. It's a very much a family celebration. But it's also a time when they gather with one another, and when they gather together in a synagogue, that's the text, that's one of the texts that's read, for the reason that it starts talking about this lamb. It also talks about a festival of 7 days, and it's a kind of a bridge text. That is how, maybe we could look at it this way, that it's been edited by people after the experience of unifying two existing Canaanite pagan worship services that were in existence in the land that Abraham was promised, when his children, the descendants of Abraham, that as we saw last time had gone down into Egypt, lived in Egypt for nearly 400 years, and then came out of Egypt in the Exodus experience and up into the land of Canaan. That was the fourfold aspect of the historical creed that we heard from Deuteronomy 26 last time. Well, what I'd like to do this afternoon is to suggest that we focus on 8 different time periods in the development of the story of the Passover. The first goes back to the historic moment when we don't have a precise date in the document. We don't know precisely which pharaoh. Historians have speculated as to which one it was, Ramses II, largely because he undertook some public work projects like, say, FDR, building the National Forest and this sort of thing, sending out the Civil Conservation Corps. Well, just as great works of national public works were undertaken in the 1930s to get out of the Depression, so also this particular pharaoh, our king, Ramses II, undertook a lot of public work projects, and so they speculate that might be the pharaoh of the Exodus. But he's not named in this story. All we know is that there came a king, or a pharaoh, who didn't know Joseph. Joseph being the dreaming boy of Jacob, who could interpret, not only dreamed himself, but who had shrewd Jungian training in Zurich, and who had to interpret dreams, or maybe he was a Freudian for all we know. But anyhow, he's a dream interpreter. And he was very gifted at telling people what their dreams meant. So this strange dream about the fat cows and the skinny cows, he told them, well, what that means is you have to put aside grain for the time when the economy is going to go sour here in Egypt. And he made a lot of sense to the pharaoh. So he put him in charge of that enormous public work project of setting aside through a vast taxation system enough grain to feed people when the famine hit. But this is centuries later, and that story about Joseph is now in the background. There's a new pharaoh, and they don't know that. These pharaohs don't know about it. There's a strange group of people that have come into the land. The texts call them the Hapiru, or we call them Hebrews. And it's a little anachronistic to be talking about Jews at this point. The word Jew doesn't come into history until several centuries later, and it describes people from the southern part of Canaan, or Judah. The Judaioi, or the Yehudi, the Jews, or the people in the south, long after the Exodus. So at this point, let's just call them the Hebrews. And let's focus on the fact that the first part of the book of Exodus talks about one little lad that is drawn from the rivers where this genocidal tyrant, Pharaoh, has ordered the Hebrew midwives to kill all the male boys, all the male kids that are born to the Hebrews, and they heroically resist that order. They disobey the command of genocide. And in one telling story that gives us the name Moshe, or drawn from the water, or Moses, the daughter of the Pharaoh herself is moved to compassion at the sight of this helpless, beautiful little child that is taken out of the waters and is saved from the what could have been the waters of death. So we'll see that water, is there going to be a lot of water stories in Exodus, and they will all bespeak either salvation or rescue or redemption on the one hand, or destruction, death, and the like on the other hand. Indeed, the great irony is we'll see is that water will be a symbol of death and destruction for the Egyptians, for the oppressors, and a sign of hope and salvation and redemption for God's people. But remember that the story that we're reading in the Bible is really collected together from precious memories and oral traditions that have been handed on for centuries and that are gathered together only quite late in history, in say 5th century or so before the time of Jesus. Back here in maybe the 13th century or so, we don't have a precise date for this event, we can characterize these people as very hard-working, oppressed peasants. They're forced to make these huge cities with no wages and oppressive conditions. In the 1930s in this country, again to refer to the CCC, we also have to refer to what the New Deal involved was a whole series of labor laws to improve the conditions of workers, because they were truly deplorable. The conditions, and it was really kind of a great movement of liberation for working people to enable them to bargain together collectively with their bosses about conditions of employment. Well, that's exactly the model, so to speak, of what's going on in the first 10, 12 chapters of Exodus. Is bricklayers union number one gets started. The principle is that one by one, the boss can pick you off and can either brutalize you or kill you or deny you wages or whatever else. But if all of us together form a community and present our demands and our needs through an effective, eloquent spokesman, then perhaps conditions might change. And that spokesman, of course, is the little boy who is drawn from the river. Moses, Moshe, the one drawn from, the one saved from the death-dealing waters. And in a series of bargains and collective negotiations, he thinks he's getting somewhere, but it turns out Pharaoh's court is full of magicians who can do tricks every bit as impressive as the wonders that God has Moses and his brother Aaron do. The historian suggests that because of the prominence of this fellow Moses, and of the group with which he is associated, the tribe of Levi, which is not one of the 12 tribes that enters into the land. It doesn't have a place of its own, so to speak. It's associated with worship. And so they assign the Levites to this fellow Moses, these wandering priests, so to speak, who, as we will see, are terribly crucial to the construction of the narrative itself. At roughly the same time, maybe 100 years or so later, and we now have letters from a place that describe that kind of interaction between the peasants and the leaders of various city-states throughout the land of Canaan. There's a lot of friction and uprising going on. We have archaeological evidence of this as well as textual evidence outside of the Bible to confirm what we know in the Bible as the books of, what books would those be? The entrance into the land and the so-called conquest of the land.
Pentateuch, the first five?
Well, actually, we'll see, if you look at the very end of the Pentateuch, you'll see that Moses is up there on Mount Nebo looking over into the Promised Land, but he doesn't get there. And we explained that on Rock Day is because he was guilty of rock abuse, that he tapped the rock twice instead of once. When God, there was one of the perils of the journey was the people got thirsty. Now that's just a joke. We don't know why Moses didn't enter into the land. But the point is that neither Moses nor any of the people enter into Canaan in the Pentateuch. My own, if you want to know my guess as to why that's the case, I'll give you a guess, but otherwise we'll move on with the story. Do you want to know my guess? Okay. My guess is that the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, weren't edited and stitched together until the Persian period. And one of the things that Cyrus the Persian did, who let the people go from Babylon back to Canaan after they were exiled, we're getting a little bit ahead of our story, as you can see, but I'll just answer your question as quickly as I can. He says, you can set up your own law, and you can set up your own regime there. And so the document called Torah, or the law, that Ezra reads out is the Pentateuch, and less this Persian liberator, Cyrus the Persian, as you see in Isaiah, in the Isaiah scroll, he's referred to as a hero, a champion of Israel. Lest they offend him, they don't make it out that their ancestors got to Canaan, no thanks to Cyrus the Persian. They just leave that part of the story out and put it in the later writing. So the law book that is read by out by Ezra and Nehemiah, in fact, doesn't include any story about entrance into the land. The sort of the constitutional law, the normative, the basic structure of life in the temple community in the Second Temple period omits the story of entrance into the land. Okay? That's my guess, and that's all it is. It's I'm trying to account for the fact that the Bible doesn't get the people into the land by that point. But what was the question that we were pondering before you asked yours? I'm afraid I don't know, so let's go back to this.
Well, when did they enter into Canaan, I think is the question.
Oh yeah, which two books describe this process in stage number two? And I thought that was one of those things that would just immediately jump into Sunday school minds from ages past. Joshua, the book of Joshua, which we could call a blitzkrieg, you know, in come the tanks and go zip, 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 you know, a three-day war sort of thing, and it's just all over in a big triumphant holy war. Or that's what Joshua is followed by the book of
Judges.
So these two books describe the so-called conquest of the land. One, a kind of a swift military conquest, a Schwartz-style sort of thing, and the second one describes it as a guerrilla warfare thing that takes decades. It's slow. It's some, you know, you win some battles, you lose some battles, you fall back, you recamp, you form another strategy, and it's full of successes and failures, and it's anything but what the book of Joshua tells us. So that should tell you that neither of those books function in ancient Israel as a kind of CNN report of war in the Middle East. That's not why they were written or how they were written. They're rather descriptive of a whole way of thinking about the past that was involved in a particular way to celebrate the present moment of what the community was doing. What do you think the community would do when they would get together at any of the shrines, hint, hint, to remember their past? What do you associate with the word shrine? I guess you guys don't go to shrines very often. So I grew up as a Catholic, and I remember relatives in Ireland going to Lourdes and so forth. It's a very pious religious event to take a pilgrimage to a shrine. You worship God. You thank God. You bless God for something that is present. That's one thing you have to, you can't leave Holden Village not knowing this much about Jewish faith. You can't bless God for something that isn't present. For example, a Jew comes over to your house and he wants to really celebrate something and really finds you a wonderful person, well, he or she might say, do you have any bread? Got to get some bread there, because why? The blessing is going to, blessed are you, Lord our God, to bring forth grain from the earth, and you've got to say it over the present bread. And why? Because everything in Jewish prayer life centers around the presence in this very, very moment, as we are gathered here, about what God means for us now. And yet it is strangely also filled with these stories of the ancestors, with these memories of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebecca and so forth. Well, that's stage number two, is that precisely at the same historic period, there are 12 groups that gather together in a kind of a mutual defense pact or an alliance of some sort, call it a confederation, if you will. It's not exactly the United States of America, it's more loosely structured than that. Call it the Confederated States of America, people that are gathered together to preserve each state's autonomy at time of war. And then they're going to go back to being Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and what have you. It's more loosely structured than the complex federal relation in between, let's say, the government in Washington, D.C. and the government in Olympia or in wherever the capital of Idaho is. Is that Helena? I'm wildly off. That's Montana. I told you I'd forgotten all my...
It's Helena, it's not Helena.
Helena, good, thank you. And is it Coeur d'Alene or Coeur d'Alene?
Coeur d'Alene.
Okay, now I've really been educated. So you get the picture that a kind of a loose confederation of 12 tribes, and I'm not going to ask you to rattle them off, they're there in the Bible if you're more curious about it, is also involved in a kind of guerrilla warfare of a peasant uprising against the leaders of various city-states throughout the land of Canaan. And over a period of nearly two centuries, this comes to success, notably in the person of Saul, the first monarch, the first king. So in stage three, Israel takes over Canaan, and it now has all the apparatus of the very things that they were struggling against, these monarchs, these heads of cities that were oppressing them. And so they have to start reshaping the narrative along a slightly different line to accommodate that moment in their history. In the fourth stage, Israel is shattered. It's actually more accurate to describe two kingdoms shortly after David's son Solomon. He's the last of the kings of a united monarchy in which all 12 of the tribes have one king governing them. And then comes a split of the kingdoms, north and south, that go their separate ways, and they don't meet for high holy days to gather for worship together. And indeed, we start getting two kinds of dialects, or two kinds of ways of describing life in these narratives. And I've put this letter J, which stands either for Jerusalem, or for the way that God is called in Hebrew, Yahweh, or we put it in English, Lord. And up here, I'll put the letter E, standing for the way they called God in Hebrew, Elohim. These northern stories have the flavor of the northern prophets, and they bespeak that kind of language. This looks, the Yahwist looks like he's a court chronicler in Jerusalem that's describing life under the monarchy in Jerusalem. In any event, the northern tribes are obliterated, and I use that word quite intentionally because we'll come back to it next Monday when we look at the obliteration of the Jews in our century. The Shoah, the elimination, the destruction of Judaism that was attempted in this century. Well, the northern tribes are literally obliterated in the year 722. This was the crisis of the prophet Isaiah, writing in the 8th century. It's the prophet Micah. These are the political background of their concerns. And they're deeply troubled by the fact that 10 of the tribes are lost and gone forever. You never hear from them again in the scriptures. You don't even get a penny postcard from Holden Village and a slow boat out on the lake. They vanish. They're gone. Lots of legends. I'm sure you've heard some of them, that they floated out past Gibraltar and landed in Ireland. And another one was seriously believed by William Tan, for example, is that they were the Native Americans. Those, the 10 lost tribes, came here to this continent. The Mormons, of course, have a different account for how this continent was populated, but never mind those sorts of legends. We just don't hear about the 10 tribes after 722. So all that's left of this promise to Abraham that we talked about on Monday is the hope that is centered in the southern kingdom of Judah. And here's, and that you could also say that Jay could help you remember that the southern kingdom, or Judah, is the kingdom of David, and we have this absolute promise, an unconditional promise, that the line of King David will go on forever and ever in 2 Samuel chapter 7. But, again, at the time of the prophet Jeremiah, we find that the kingdom of the empire of Babylon, what is modern-day Iraq, emperor comes to Jerusalem, lays siege as the Assyrians had done in the 8th century and failed to destroy Jerusalem. The Babylonians succeed where the Assyrians had failed, and the kingdom of Judah is destroyed. The people who are left, the remnant, the little tiny stub that's left, go to two places. Well, one of them is Babylon. You've heard of the Babylonian captivity. No good Lutheran could not have heard of the Babylonian captivity, right? It really means Rome, and the whore of Babylon is, of course, the Pope, but we're getting ahead of our story to tell that one. In any event, the other place, does anybody know where Jeremiah and other Jews went to escape the Babylonian captivity?
Egypt.
Egypt, that's exactly right. They went down to Egypt. Indeed, there's a verse in the book of Deuteronomy, which seems to be a quite late addition, because it talks about being brought back along the very road that I promised you back in the time of the original Exodus narrative, you would never see this road again. It's going to be out of Egypt into the land, only now it's out of the land of Canaan, back into Egypt. So there's this great irony that the Exodus narrative itself, the Passover event itself, winds up with the Jews in exile in Egypt. And out of that community, of course, comes a very thriving group in Alexandria, or Alexandria. But the big bulk of the group went to Babylon. And there they pined for returning to Jerusalem one day. Some of them stayed behind when finally Cyrus the Persian let them go home. But eventually, that's what happens to them. Now, how does the story, which we're basically familiar with, and I'm not going to go through that in any great detail, take a different interpretation as they go through these five different periods of the line of the development of their history? Well, we're used to thinking in sort of Cecil B. DeMille terms that everybody was there in Egypt, and then Moses called them one night after some unsuccessful bargaining that turns successful, and you're, all right, tonight's the night, folks, let's go. And then you see the waters parted. You can see it at Universal Studios if you missed the movie, and how Hollywood did the trick. And it's this kind of magic working God that intervenes on behalf of his people and gets them all out of there and then brings them into Canaan, and it's a nice, neat, quick job. But as we say, the historical evidence that we know about how Israel entered into the land is in fact far more complicated. And so are the people who are involved in this story. For example, we see that Moses and the Levites are given considerable prominence as the most likely folks involved in the original event. You wouldn't want to have the original event without Moses. But was that the group that was necessarily the peasants who were rising up against their masters in Canaan? Well, there might be two separate groups. But in any event, they link up. They join up in the new. And at this point, it's important to reshape the narrative to portray the Pharaoh as a genocidal tyrant who was unwilling to negotiate under normal conditions and who would only do so if he was pressured to do so. Namely, the political situation of the Canaanites becomes the sort of backdrop of the story of Exodus. They read that back into the story to include that into the situation. In other words, they're giving an historical interpretation of the events to bring it up to speed, to bring it up to the present moment. Not just to have it as a memory of some guy called Moses way back when, but to have it describe their history at the very moment when these things were happening to them. And that may sound to us cheating or something like that, or fudging on history or something like that. But that's only because we live after the 19th century, when history started to be thought of as the description of precisely how things happen when they happen. Now, be honest. I know you heard that stuff in whether high school or wherever you learned something about history as a science. It was typically in high school. It certainly wasn't in grammar school, where we were taught whole bunches of historical lies, like A, the Puritans were freedom-loving colonials that omitted the execution of Quakers or things like that. We were taught all kinds of garbagey things in grammar school as part of our national history. But at some point, I think we all got the impression that an historian should always be, telling it like it was, with some very careful precision. But forget that for a moment. Think about your own family. Is there anyone here who can name your great-great-grandmother on your father's side? For sure. Do you know where she was born? At what time of the day? Do these things matter so much so that you would be called a liar if, when your own little grandchild put that question to you, you sort of told a story about the best of your ability of where you think you came from? Maybe it was Germany and you're not sure if it was Pomerania or even where Pomerania is for that matter, but maybe it's some other part of the world and you do the best you can to account for your roots. Well, that's much closer to the kind of experience that Israel has in constructing its stories of its origins. It's more like this kind of family search for roots. Remember the film series on TV that Alex Haley did about his past? And I thought it was an absolutely wonderful story that really exposed to us whites the pain of the crossing from Africa, the tragedy of the laws of status and control, the brutality of the system. It made me weep, literally, to see that scene where Kunta Kinte has his foot chopped off so that he won't attempt to run away again. I couldn't help but cry at that moment. I felt, my God, if a story ever could connect you, it was this telling of this story. And then Alex Haley got into this absolutely foolish argument with the London Times that sent some dumb reporter down to West Africa to see whether or not this was indeed the precise village and all kinds of stuff like that. So we don't have to get too troubled, in short, about the power of history to move us if we just put to one side and bracket some of the stuff that we got in high school or perhaps in college about history as a very precise science with a clearly defined attempt to establish the facts of the past. The facts, after all, are established only by our attempt to interpret and to understand the past. And that's exactly what I want to say about the Passover narratives, is that they are attempts to bring that past into the present moment of the life of Israel at worship. The third stage where we saw when Israel takes over Canaan, well, now it becomes necessary to account for the monarchy, because it's not that these presents are rebelling against a king whom they hate and despise, and let's call this city-state guy Pharaoh, and let's reshape the story to make it, along those lines. Now they have a new enemy to fight, the Philistines, who are very well organized themselves and have their own kind of army and set of oppressive acts against the people. And so the story gets edited again, and Moses is thought of as the leader of all Israel, not of one tribe down in Egypt, but he's the guy who's in charge of the whole shebang. And we have the idea that Pharaoh is the leader of all Egypt, read all the Philistines. Indeed, we now can think of the Exodus as a struggle between two peoples, not a class struggle of peasants against overlords and masters who are treating them harshly as laborers, but as a national struggle. And let's call it Israel against Egypt. Now, of course, flash this forward into 1992 and the contemporary politics of the Middle East, and you can see that's fraught with a lot of difficulty, that reading of the story. Luckily for us, Israel and Egypt are now at peace. But there was a time in my life, and in the life, I take it, of the vast majority of us here, I can see one or two that would be exceptions, but most of us can remember the day when there was war, and the rumor of war continually between Israel and Egypt as nation states. And it's that kind of political background that we need to see in the Passover narrative itself. Well, in the fourth stage and down into the fifth stage, when you have the restructuring of the Exodus story to stress that liberation is the act not of a community organizer helping out a class or a national leader like Moses, it is the act of Yahweh. It is the gracious, saving intervention of God. Why? Because now that's all that the Jews, and now it's appropriate historically to use that term, the Jews. That's all that's left. Israel is gone. So the Jews have only the temple. They don't have a king. They don't have civil government with all of the full apparatus that they did under either the Northern Kingdom or the Southern Kingdom. All they have left is the life of religious worship in the temple. And the priests are the ones who are in charge. So now we retell the Exodus story all over again to emphasize its sacred character, that it is a kind of a liturgy of liberation, if you wish, but all of the same old symbols, water, blood, bread, are now interpreted liturgically, so that they're now inserted into the life of the worship of the community. Always, 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 to make the point that I made at the beginning of this conversation, that prayer for a Jew is remembering the past so as to enter into that moment right here and right now, in the very present. It is to make present, to make actual, the saving, gracious gifts of God. Let me just ask you, if you have Bibles with you, to turn to a couple of passages in the book of Deuteronomy to illustrate this point, and just call on one or two of you to read them out for us. One of you read Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 20 to 21. Deuteronomy is the fifth of these books that we call in the Pentateuch. Chapter 6, Deuteronomy 6. All of the verses I'm going to ask you to read are from Deuteronomy, just to keep it simple.
When your son asks you in time, mighty hand.
Okay, now who is this we? That's the question I want you to ponder as we go through some of these passages. Chapter 10, verse 19, and then somebody else already flipped forward to chapter 15, verse 15, but somebody find 10, 19 and read that. Okay, who is this you? Who is this you? Is it you? Is it you? Yeah, it's you. It's you. But at least we can say that it is the reader of Deuteronomy at the time this is being read out in the liturgical celebration. It's you. It's you. Who is this we? It's we. It's us, folks. That's the point of Deuteronomy. He is now making it liturgically present at the time that this is being read out. Who's got 15:15?
Today.
Okay, now who again are the slaves in Egypt? It's us. We are these slaves, and we are telling this story afresh. Just to skip forward, chapter 20, verse 1. So whether you're telling your kids the story, whether you're getting the point of the law, or anything like that, it is in the present moment that this is occurring. Chapter 20, verse 1, and then somebody else do flip forward to 24, 22. And we will have done with this little exercise. Now, just think about that verse for a moment. It's clearly describing both the past and the present in the same verse, isn't it? Want to hear it again? Or just look at it in your text and just think about that. It's both describing the past and the present. And that's just manifestly clear in that particular text. Let's close off this discussion with in chapter 24, verse 22. One of the things that flows from remembering that you're a slave in Egypt is that you remember that you're not an Egyptian. Because one of the temptations for a member of Israel is to become an Egyptian, is to assimilate, is to become just like the local culture, and to obliterate the memories so that you don't remember whether you came from, you know, Pomerania or Belgium or any other place. You're just American. You don't know where you came from. Who is this we, the people, in our Constitution? That's a pretty complicated question, isn't it? Let me ask the women here. Did it include you at the original moment when those words, we, comma, the people, in order to do all these wonderful things, to promote justice, ensure domestic tranquility, do hereby ordain and establish these United States, does it mean women?
No.
I guess in Wyoming you could say it meant women in the 1867 or so was the first state to acknowledge the legitimacy of women participating in the communal life by voting. But you know that Woodrow Wilson, great liberal champion of democracy that he was, none of you that know anything of the story of the suffragettes know that he sent the federal goons to crack the heads and to break the skulls of the suffragettes that were marching in Washington to get the vote for women. Did it mean African Americans? Did it mean Native Americans? Did it mean Roman Catholics, Jews? Well, the answer to that question of Roman Catholics and Jews is there was a provision that they could have federal office, but they couldn't vote. In most states, in the overwhelming majority of the states, in 11 of the 13, it meant the absolute denial of membership in the community to the blacks virtually until this century. We made a passing attempt after the Civil War to fix that, but in other words, these questions of who are we anyhow are exactly what's at issue in the construction of the Passover narratives. They're at the heart of Israel's attempt to answer the question, who are we anyhow? And if you forget that you were the slaves, you might get into the position of thinking of yourself as an Egyptian, that it's okay to be a boss beating up on your workers, treating them unfairly. It's okay to have all these genocidal feelings towards, and now who are the slaves? Well, the answer is to the aliens, the strangers among you. And Deuteronomy is at pains in this passage to make clear. In the present moment, look around you. You see aliens. You see people who are your field workers and that. And you're treating them just like the way we were treated. So don't forget. That's the 11th commandment in Judaism after the Holocaust. Never forget. Lod Zakur. Never forget. We will never let this happen again is the point of that commandment. And the quickest way for Israel to get destroyed is to forget her memories of who she is. Where did she come from? And so annually it has this meal, this sacred meal, in which the memory of who she is and where she came from and to what end and what is her goal in the world because as a consequence of this gracious intervention of God, of the freedom of a people in the face of oppression and the liberation of a people in the face of injustice. They gather en familia, as I said, in the family to celebrate this thing, and they gather in the congregation, in the synagogue, to hear these stories. The matzah is, we have about 8 or 10 minutes, and I'm going to go very quickly now to get to the Christian part and then read you some Jewish interpretations of how they have interpreted this story. The matzah for Christians turns out in the Lucan narrative in chapter 22 of Luke, in verse 1 and then in verse 7 and verse 14, in three different places, he puts in a time signature to make clear to his community, remember, this is Passover, this is Paschal stuff, that's the kind of meal that's going on. And then he has Jesus doing with the cup of blessing and with the matzah, the unleavened bread, exactly what Jews had done when they got to Canaan and found these two separate holidays, one an agrarian one where the farmers would celebrate their unity by this unleavened bread, getting the yeast out of the house sort of thing, and starting up a whole new dough, a whole new loaf, so to speak, for a week, 7 days of no yeast in the house, nothing to make the bread rise. They had that holiday. And then the shepherds had a different holiday, and again, to celebrate their unity and their livelihood. They were afraid of, let's put it very bluntly, spooks or demons that would just destroy the sheep. And I suppose some of you who were scientists could tell, you know, that it really was amoeba or something like this, or even given it a formal biological name that was attacking the herd. But that isn't the point. These were ancient primitive people, and they were just afraid that the flock would disappear. And so the way that they had of coping with that reality was by killing one of the little baby lambs in the springtime and taking the blood and sprinkling it all over the tent posts and all over the flock. And that would keep the spooks away, keep the demons away, and ensure that they had lots of lambs throughout the year and lots of ability to thrive as a clan or as a family, as a community. Well, those two pre-existing festivals, the Jews, or I should say the Israelites, took over and historicized. They gave them a historical reference back to their experience in Passover. Well, so does Jesus do the same thing. He historicizes the existing Jewish festival of Passover and gives it reference to himself and his community. He says over the bread and the wine, first over the bread, this is myself given for you, and over the cup, this cup is the new covenant shed for you. The blood shed for you is the way of establishing the new bond between himself and all of his disciples. So he gives a radical new historical interpretation to the Passover event, suggesting that he is it. John does it in a slightly different way. He suggests that the Last Supper that Jesus had with his disciples wasn't a Passover meal. How do we know that? Because the next day, at noontime, when the Passover lambs are being killed in the temple, that's the time signature that he puts into his passion narrative, suggesting that Jesus is the lamb being going forward, you know, as we saw last Monday, carrying his own wood just as Isaac did to go to the Holocaust. So Jesus carries the wood of his cross, and as the perfect Lamb of God, offers the one sacrifice once and forever that will do away with all need to repeat any other sacrifice, and establishes his community in that way. But the same idea, the Lamb who is pierced with the sword, or with the, you know, poked with this big long thing, for two reasons. One, to establish the same point of contact with Christian sacramental life, namely blood and water flow out, symbols in John's community for what sacraments?
Holy Communion and Baptism.
Holy Communion and Baptism. So that the waters of the Exodus narrative, which are death-dealing to the Egyptian, life-giving to the Israelites, are interpreted in the Christian community we see in Romans 6. That death and life struggle is exactly what the Passover of a Christian is all about. And baptism was only celebrated this once, when all of these texts would come rushing in, and when you'd get the memory of what happened back in the Exodus and what's happening in your life. Again, here and now, and only then could you be invited to the Lord's Supper and participate in that kind of nurturing event that would build a community together. Flashing forward, it is highly significant that the African Americans, when they came to describe their experience, first of all, after the monstrosity of being denied their own religious heritage, they were forced to convert to Christianity from the Western African religions that they had, either kind of animism of sorts or else Islam. Those were the two major religions of Africans at the time. And they were forced converts to Christianity, but what they brought to the church when they came was extraordinary. And it's all out of Exodus. It's all out of Passover talk. You know, go down Moses, let my people go. All of this stuff is they put a very different spin again, retelling the Passover narrative to bring it up to speed, to bring it up to the present moment, describing their conditions of slavery in very powerful, evocative language. And then the irony of people like Thomas Jefferson writing the Declaration of Independence, in which George III is Massa, and we white folks are the slaves. Can we think about that one? We're the slaves in the Declaration of Independence, never mind the conditions of brutality that we imposed on it. It's in face of these ironies of what does freedom really mean? What does justice really mean? That the Passover narrative has this enormous potential for good in our society, creating a whole new way of thinking of the world. It's just dramatically liberating of the sort of things that confine us to terribly oppressive conditions. Well, let me just conclude with a couple of passages from attempts to reform the Jewish Seder. An attempt to make it a political interpretation of a community that is organized and ready to go. The image that I gave you of the Bricklayers Union number 1 is not original to me. It comes from a rabbi by the name of Abraham Musti. This is from the Freedom Seder, a new Haggadah. It's the kind of retelling of the story in Hebrew, Haggadah, the story. And tomorrow we'll see Halakha. That's how they redo the law. So first, the historical narrative goes. And again, you know, I suppose I should start it the way any Jew would do. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Borei Pri Hagafen. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, ruler of the universe, you create the fruit of the vine. You have made of one earth, one flesh, all the peoples of the world. You exalt humankind by breathing the life of the mind and the love of freedom into us. You sanctify us on this moment so that we may know and say what is truly holy and what is profane, what is freedom and what slavery is. And then flashing forward to the Abraham Musti. Moses lived in a period of dictatorship. You know, the Jews always, you know, tell stories when they're sitting around the Seder. If you've ever been to a Seder, you know that. If you've never been to one, go next year. Forget the canons of the early church that prohibited Christians from going to Seder. Go. Find a Jewish friend. Make a friend as part of your commitment at Holden to become friends with a Jew and celebrate Passover next year with a Jew to find out what that's like for them, because it's truly wonderful. It's mind-boggling. His people were slaves. The bosses made them work under a speed-up system and committed horrible atrocities such as trying to kill all the boy babies born to the Jews. Moses himself was saved from such a death only because his mother hid him in a reed basket in the Nile River. There he was found by the daughter of Pharaoh, which is what they used to call the dictator in Egypt in those days. The princess took Moses to the royal palace and had him brought up as her own son. When Moses was a young man, he became curious about the Hebrew slaves, and one day he went to the brickyards where some of them were working. The first thing he saw was an Egyptian boss hitting a Hebrew laborer. Moses was a powerful young man. He lost his temper. He hit the boss and killed him. He buried the body hastily in the sand and went back to the palace. But a fire had been kindled in Moses' heart, a fire of concern about his people and their suffering. The next day he went back to the hot brickyards. Then he learned two things that those who try to help their fellows often discover. First, slaves often spend as much time and energy fighting each other as they do fighting their common oppressor. Second, slaves do not always welcome their deliverers. They get accustomed to being slaves. They kind of like it. Even after they've been free, if freedom brings hardship, they want to go back to the flesh pots of Egypt. This time, Moses found two Hebrews fighting each other. When he rebuked them, they turned to him and said, "Who made you our boss? You mean to kill us as you killed that Egyptian yesterday?" Now Moses feared that in order to turn suspicion away from themselves, they would turn him in. So he concluded it was a good idea to split. So he ran away, and then to tell the story about Midian in the desert and stuff like that. You get the flavors. It's a retelling of the story by a labor organizer. This is right out of the sort of lefty stuff of Jews in America in the 30s. When they were right behind Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Labor Act, and obviously this is a way of appreciating the Exodus, but it's you know, a very different way. Abraham Musti, I'll give you the title of the book, it's called The Freedom Seder, and it's full of all kinds of of stuff about the Vietnam War and American corporations and this and that and the other thing. You know, it's just right up to the moment at the time that that one was read. Well, now, one of the things that you, as most of you in this room are women, should know is that the struggle of Jewish women, or Judith, as plural, Judith, Jewish women. Any Judys here? Any Judys? Okay. Well, a Judith is a Jewish woman. So, Judoth, Jewish women, plural, have a hard time making into a very male world in Judaism. And there's lots of just absolutely wonderful ferment going on within Judaism in this, I will say, this century. But more particularly in the last 20 years, they've made great progress, such as Dorothy announced at breakfast this morning the first time that a Lutheran a synod had elected a Lutheran bishop that was a woman. Well, listen to this redoing of the Passover narrative called the Jewish Women's Haggadah. Havarot Shalom, that means peace to you, my friends. We're gathered here tonight to celebrate the festival of the liberation of the Jewish people. Passover is the night when all the families of Israel gather to celebrate and strengthen their ties to each other and to all Jews. We too are a family, a growing family. We too have ties we hope to strengthen. Even when we are not related by blood, we are related by something even stronger, sisterhood. And she describes in a footnote what a difficulty it is for her to construct a Seder, a Passover narrative that doesn't have, you know, the squabbling old grandfather and all the kids who's spilling wine and all the usual things that happen at Passover. But she designed this for Jewish women to get together and to remember their heritage and to do things a little bit differently. So the we in this narrative, really it should be read out by a woman. So I'm going to stop here and ask one of you who's got a good voice to read this paragraph here, and you'll get the flavor of what Jewish women are doing to read. Excuse me. Just right there, that big long section right there, and then we'll conclude. Right. Mm-hmm.
As we hold this cup of wine, we remember our sisters in the land of Egypt who fearlessly stood up to the Pharaoh. Our legends tell us that Pharaoh, in the time-honored pattern of oppressors, tried to get Jews to collaborate in murdering their own people. He summoned the top two Jewish midwives, Shifra and Puah. Some legends say one of them was Yaakovet.
Sounds good.
Who was also Moshe's mother, and commanded them to kill newborn Jewish males at birth and to report the birth of Jewish females so that they could be raised to become prostitutes. Pharaoh tried at first to win over the midwives by making sexual advances to them. When they repulsed these, he threatened them with death by fire. The midwives did not carry out Pharaoh's command. Instead of murdering the male infants, they took special care of them. If a mother was poor, they went around to the other women, collecting food for her and her child. When Pharaoh asked the midwives to account for all the living children, they made up the excuse that Jewish women gave birth so fast that they did not summon midwives in time. Very smart. Like our Jewish sisters through the ages, those in Egypt were strong and courageous in the face of oppression. Our sages recognized this when they said, "The Jews were liberated from Egypt because of the righteousness of the women."
Yeah. So she lifts up the women in the story and to celebrate this thing. And in short, we have to conclude by saying, whenever we celebrate either the bread or the cup, we're celebrating our liberation right here, right now. And we have all kinds of ways of telling it, but not the way that we have typically used in the past, using this most holy moment of the Christian life to beat up on the Jews.